Hello, and welcome to the Luna's Reading Corner podcast, where we bring your questions to your favorite authors. I'm your host, Lacey Lawaji, and New Moon Girls member Jonah joined me when we chatted with Karen Cushman. Karen is the author of Grayling Song, Newbery Award winner The Midwife's Apprentice, Catherine Called Birdie, and other books for girls. We talked to her about her books and her life as a writer. Let's listen to what she has to say. So I think that we'll just go ahead and dive right in, Karen. We're joined today by Jonah, who is a 14-year-old reader of your work.
Jonah?
Uh-huh. Okay. Hi, Jonah.
Hi.
And Jonah and I will both be taking turns asking the interview questions, and the interview questions that we've gathered today are from me and from Jonah, and also from some of the girls who use our website who sent their questions on to us.
Okay.
Are you ready to get started?
I'm ready.
So we're going to start out with some general questions about your life as a writer, and then we'll go into some more specific questions about your work.
Okay.
Could you talk a little bit about what inspired your story ideas?
What inspired my story ideas? Well, when I talk to groups of young people, they often ask, where do you get your ideas? And I came up with this this metaphor, which is Legos. That one Lego is just a colored plastic block, but you put this Lego with that Lego and another one, and pretty soon you can build a house or a car or a spaceship, anything you want. And that's, I think, how ideas come. Little bits, little pieces of things that are intriguing and seem to get filed away in my head until another one comes and hooks up with that. Excuse me. Hold on one second. So there's not just a girl, but there's a girl who does this, and she lives there, and this happens to her, and all of those pieces come together and build a story. Does that answer the question, you think?
Yeah, that's a really neat metaphor. I've never heard it described that way before. How long would you say it usually takes between, you know, you're sort of pulling these different pieces together over time until you have enough to start a story? How long do you hold some of these pieces in your mind before you kind of get enough to start writing around?
Well, I tell people that it took me 50 years to write my first book. So Catherine Called Birdie was bouncing around there, bits and pieces, for 50 years. But I think it takes, you know, a number of years. I would say 3 to 5, something like that. So while I'm working on one, there are a couple of others bubbling around there, and I'm seeing things and writing a note on a piece of paper or on the computer and starting to build a base to make a story from.
What do you like best about writing, and what do you like least?
Aha. What I like least is writing. What I like best is sitting alone in my room and making up stories. I really like to do that, and I've always done that, and I used to tell stories to kids when I was a kid, to other kids, and make things up, and I really like to do that. So I think that's my favorite part, is building the story. But taking it out of my head and putting it on paper or on the computer is very difficult for me. Catherine Patterson, the writer, once described the process as like a spider pulling a web out of her own guts. And that's very much how it feels to me.
I think it's important for girls to hear that, because there are a lot of writers who actually find the writing process hard. And I think when girls come up against that, you know, they get discouraged, or they think it means they're not a good writer or a real writer, but that's actually a pretty common experience.
I think so, and I think that the harder it is, the deeper you have to dig inside yourself, and probably eventually the richer the writing will be. That easy writing is much more shallow, and I think that it's that difficulty, that digging inside of ourselves to come up with these ideas or these situations and these characters that can make it much richer, make them richer.
Before you were focused on writing full-time, what other jobs have you had?
Well, the last job I had before I was writing, I was working in a master's program in museum studies. The last couple of years, I was in charge of everybody's master's thesis. I was on the committee for each one. So I worked with students who were trying to turn a germ of an idea, like museums and world peace.
Mm-hmm.
Some huge idea, and boiling it down to something that could be tackled and written in 100 pages. So I learned a lot about condensing huge ideas and making them more specific. I learned about writing and not write, how not to write. I learned about taking an idea and seeing it through to the end. So I think that that job really helped me become a writer instead mm-hmm. of somebody who had all of these ideas all the time and never did anything about them. I used to tell my husband, listen to this, I have a great idea for a story. And I would tell him, and that would be the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
and then at one point, about 25 years now, I said to him, listen to this, I have a great idea for a story. I woke up with this picture of this girl at odds with her family and her society, and who wanted to be herself but had no power and no value. And he said, you've been saying that for 20 years now, and I've never seen a word on paper. So this time I refuse to read it. I refuse to listen. But
wow.
I'll read it if you'll write it down. So, under protest, I wrote down what turned to be a 7-page outline for Catherine Called Birdie.
Wow.
And I think I couldn't have done that without the experience of helping 50 young people do the same thing, taking an idea from their head,
yeah.
and making it workable and putting it on paper.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that job. I had a lot of crummy jobs. I was what they called the girl in men's underwear in a Kmart-like store in Los Angeles for a while. And I worked with a telephone company where we were not encouraged to tell stories. I worked as the assistant to the head of education at a Jewish seminary for several years, which is where I met my husband.
Oh, okay.
So that was a good job.
So what does it mean to be the girl in men's underwear? I think that's something our listeners will have questions about.
I was in the men's underwear department.
Oh, I see. You worked in the men's underwear
yes.
department. I see.
That's right. The store was like a Kmart or a Target kind of thing, and that was my department.
I see. I thought that
was for a summer.
You had to wear
no,
men's
no,
underwear
I didn't
for
wear
your
men's
job.
Underwear. No.
And I thought that seems like an odd requirement.
What were your favorite books when you were a kid?
Ah, what were my favorite books when I was a kid? You know, I was a kid a very long time ago, and we didn't have nearly as many books or nearly as good. I had, read over and over the Bobbsey Twins series, which is about two sets of twins and their adventures. I liked the historical and regional novels of Lois Lenski, which really got me interested in other people and other times. She wrote about sharecroppers and pickers in Florida. Strawberry Girl was one of hers, and I liked those books. But mostly I just went to the library and picked whatever I could reach off the shelf in the children's department and read that.
So we have two of our members from the site. Their names are Bobby and Kate. Both asked if you would talk a little bit about what inspired you to write The Midwife's Apprentice.
Oh, The Midwife's Apprentice was a title that came to me first before anything about a story. I liked that title. It spoke of birth with midwife and apprentice was about education and learning. So I really liked that title. But I had no idea what the book was about or how it was going to go. I just put it on a piece of paper, possible title, Midwife's Apprentice, and put it in a folder, and put the folder in the filing cabinet. But after I sent off Catherine Colberti and had been accepted and they were going to publish it, I had a long wait. So I pulled out that folder and looked at the title and sat down at the computer and said, I don't know what this is about or where I'm going. But I started to type, and the first things that came out were this homeless child sleeping on the dung heap. Hmm. That was the beginning. So I had the beginning, and I knew at the end that she was going to succeed, and that maybe it wouldn't be succeeding in the regular way, but it would be succeeding in being persistent and determined. So I had a very beginning and a very end. And then the line, and the cat went with her, came to me, and then I was off. And I was helped writing that book by my own cat, Lobelia, who is an orange cat very much like the one on the front cover of the hardback copy, the book, the hardback cover. And she helped me write by walking over the computer keys. but what she wrote later had to be edited out because nobody could understand it.
That sounds like my cat. She tries to add her own thoughts when I'm writing as well.
They tend to do that, yes.
So it sounds like with The Midwife's Apprentice, you had a really clear outline for Catherine Colberti, and then with The Midwife's Apprentice, you had the title, and it sounded like in that one you sort of figured it out as you went along. Is that correct?
That's right. That is correct. That's
okay.
The way it happened, and that's not the way I usually write. I usually have more of an idea before I start. But the Midwife's Apprentice was magical in that way, that it just came out as I was sitting at the computer, and it took 9 months to write.
Oh, that's fitting, isn't it?
Yes, it's fitting for a book about childbirth, but
yeah.
Also was the shortest time that I've ever spent on a book. Most of them are much longer than that.
Okay. I remember very vividly reading The Midwife's Apprentice because my mom had bought it when I was in middle school or high school. She loved anything having to do with medical stuff. She was a nurse. So she would always buy these children's books that were related to, like, medical stories, and I remember being home from school sick one day and just, like, reading the whole thing start to finish. Like, I'd put it down for, like, a little bit, be like, oh, I have a headache, I'm going to rest, and then, like, 5 minutes later, I'd be like, oh, I'll just read a little bit more.
Well, good. That's the kind of reader I like.
Yes.
Yes,
I very much enjoyed it. After writing mostly historical fiction, what made you decide to write fantasy with Grayling songs?
Well, once again, I sat down at the computer. I wanted to do something different after all that historical fiction, but I didn't know what it was going to be. And I sat down and I started to write, and what came out was the passage in Grayling's song about Grayling finding her mother rooted to the ground and her feet growing into roots. And I said, holy cow, I'm writing a fantasy. So I had no idea, I had no clue that that's what it was going to be. And then, of course, I was committed to this idea of a world in which magic existed. Didn't always work, but it existed. And I found that writing a fantasy adds an extra step to historical fiction. I mean, if you're writing a book of historical fiction, you're bound by actual events, by history, you know, all of those pesky things that can get in the way. So I thought, oh, I wouldn't have to deal with that in fantasy, but it turns out that there is many rules and boundaries and as many facts in history in a fantasy world as there are in the real world. Only you have to make them up. You have to figure out what they are, and then you have to follow those rules. So it did add that extra step, which was very interesting to me. I really didn't comprehend that before I dug in and started to write that.
So what was different about the writing process when you were writing a fantasy instead of historical fiction?
Well, writing fantasy, because this world of the of Grayling Song was, you know, vaguely medieval.
Mm-hmm.
I already knew some of those rules and boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So that helped a lot. But I didn't have to pay specific attention to dates, to events, to who was the king, or
mm-hmm.
you know, what was happening in this country or in this this specific place, which I would have had to do if I were writing historical fiction. So there is more of an emphasis on actual events and people. Even if I'm writing a story that's not about them, I have to know what's going on in the world, whereas I didn't have to do that. I could just have an anonymous king or an anonymous
mm-hmm.
soldier or soldiers going to battle, and I didn't have to be specific. So that was different.
Jonah and I both read Grayling's Song recently, so it's pretty fresh in our minds. And one thing that I noticed when I read it was that I felt like your background writing historical fiction really grounded that world in a way that sometimes you don't see in fantasy. Like, it felt very real. And to me, it reminded me of, you know, how there, throughout history, there's been sort of this idea that wise women are witches. So it was like taking that a step further to where they actually were using magic.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Like, magic didn't always work, and it was sometimes harmful, but it did exist.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was an interesting experiment. I don't know if I will do it again, but we'll see.
Can you tell us about your research process for your historical book?
Well, when I started, the research was all library research. I lived near the University of California in Berkeley and spent a lot of time in their libraries looking for books about the Middle Ages. So I found, you know, a kind of grounding in the medieval world. But they didn't have books about what I was interested in. I wanted to know about the lives of children
mm-hmm.
long ago. I wanted to know where they went to the bathroom, what they ate in the winter, you know, when
mm-hmm.
there was no fresh food. And I couldn't find that there. So I started looking in the public library in the children's department, and found, you know, growing up in the 13th century
mm-hmm.
and books like that were less scholarly but a little bit more broader in what they talked about. So it was all library research. Now I can do a lot of research online. There are amazing things online. For Alchemy and Maggie Swan, I found recreations of alchemical laboratories, either
oh, wow.
real that people had, I mean, laboratories. Either real that people had put together or drawings of what they might have looked like,
mm-hmm.
which really helped for me to be able to see some of these instruments and implements and to see what their working conditions would be like. I found online collections of medieval broadsides, which were sort of one-page newspapers almost, about a specific event or complaining about the government, these one-page things that they hawked on the streets. And there are a number of institutions around the world that have collected these,
uh-huh.
and now they are reproduced online. You can actually see the broadside, you know, from 1312,
wow.
and what it looked like, and the language. All of these resources online are just amazing. When it comes to facts, I am a little bit more skeptical and will check anytime I use a particular fact that I have found, make sure that other people believe the same thing, because I know that the Internet is kind of the Wild West and
mm-hmm.
lots of things get posted. So I have to be a little bit more critical about that, but I do use it a lot.
Do you have consultants or anyone that you can, you know, run something by? Like, I know that it can be hard to find a specific detail that you want to use in your story. Is there like a professor or a scholar or anyone that you're able to say, hey, would
there
this...
There isn't any one person.
Okay.
But I have contacted professors at different schools and emailed them.
Mm-hmm.
When I was writing Rodzina about the children on the orphan train,
mm-hmm.
I was getting a lot of different information about what the bathroom facilities were like. So I emailed somebody in the Western History Department at the University of Colorado, I think it was, and asked, you know, which of these would be more likely, and we talked about it, and that was very helpful, you know, to have some kind of expertise, not mm-hmm. just me, the internet, and the library book.
Yeah.
When you sit down to begin a new book or story, do you start writing at the beginning, or do you start somewhere in the middle?
I start from the beginning, usually, and I like to have the beginning really carefully, thoughtfully done, because it's going to establish the character's voice and kind of the tone of the story, and usually I know the beginning and the end. It's just all that middle that is more difficult for me. Mm-hmm. So I just start at the beginning and write on from there. If I get stuck, I might go and write a passage that I like, but it will go somewhere else in the book and I don't know where yet. So I do have some of those bouncing around the computer at times, but it's definitely a beginning to end process.
Mm-hmm. How many times do you typically edit a book or a story?
Ooh, hundreds.
Oh.
And sometimes it's just a couple of words in a chapter. Sometimes it's recasting the whole chapter. When I was doing school visits, I would take along with me 27 versions of the first page of Catherine Called Bertie, which I saved. And that's not all there were, but I wanted to get that beginning just right. As mm-hmm. I said, it's going to establish the tone of the book, but also that's what will draw a reader in.
Mm-hmm.
So I have 27 versions of the first page of Catherine Called Bertie. It seems to me that a first draft is not writing. It's just getting stuff down on paper.
Uh-huh.
That later you craft, you write, you rewrite, you change. That's where the writing comes in.
How many drafts do you typically put one of your books through before you get feedback from your agent or your editor?
She likes me to have it completely done, not a partial manuscript.
Okay.
And she likes to have it in pretty good shape. So
mm-hmm.
it's a lot of drafts before it even gets to her. So I'm always surprised when she comes back with these, you know, 5-page editorial letters with all of these problems that she sees.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty done.
Yeah. We have just a few more questions before we
okay.
wrap up. One of them is from one of our readers. Her name is Mackenzie, and she's wondering if there is a question that you wished readers asked you. I think that what she's getting at is she's wondering if there's something you might want to talk about more often that you don't get asked very much.
One of my favorite questions to be asked is how I got the news of the Newbery Medal.
Oh, yeah. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. For Catherine Called Bertie, I knew when what the Newberries were. They're an award given by the American Library Association, and they announced them at their midwinter meeting, which is usually on the East Coast sometime. And we were at that time in California, in the Bay Area. So I knew that they were going to announce it early that morning, but I knew that I would never have a chance because it was my first book, you know, and they weren't going to give me anything. So my husband and I went to bed, and about 4 in the morning, the telephone rang. It was 7 o'clock on the East Coast, and they were announcing the winners. So he picked up the phone, and I heard somebody talking, and he said, "Do you know what time this is? What time it is?" And they said, "Wah, rah, rah, rah." And I said, "Who is it? Is there a problem? Was something wrong?" You know, and he said, "It's some librarian." So I gave it to me. He gave me the phone, and she said that Catherine Called Bertie had been named a Newbery Honor book.
Wow.
Well, we were pretty excited and happy, but he was embarrassed how he had handled that telephone call. So he was sure of two things. One, that The Midwife's Apprentice was going to win the whole thing the next year, and two, that he was going to handle that phone call better. So the next year, we knew what was going to happen. We knew the phone might ring. early in the morning. I said, they'll never give me a Newbery twice in a row. Don't even think about it, but he was certain. So he put the phone next to his side of the bed and practiced sitting up calmly and smoothly and answering it, even if it was 4 in the morning. Well, the phone did ring 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. He reached out to get it, and it fell on the floor and bounced under the bed. So there he was under the bed, scrambling around looking for the phone, and I'm screeching, get the phone, as if if I didn't answer, they'd say, well, we'll just give it to somebody else then.
Yeah.
So it finally came out from under the bed with the telephone, and they did announce that the midwife's apprentice had won the Newbery medal, the gold medal.
Wow.
So that was pretty exciting.
Yeah.
All the way around, both the phone call and the way he handled it. And he went and got a bottle of champagne that he had hidden in the back of the refrigerator.
Oh,
he
had
was
he?
So certain that it was going to win. Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. That was the first and last time I've had champagne at 5 in the morning.
So it's hard to gracefully take a phone call that early in the morning. It sounds like you're prepared.
That's right. You can't be prepared enough. Yes.
Yes. That's why we schedule our interviews a little later in the day.
Yes, right. I appreciate that. Yes.
So what advice do you have, Karen, for young writers?
It's boring advice. What I say is read a lot, especially in the area that you're interested in. Read everything you can. Practice writing. Don't think you're going to sit down and write a novel. It's like basketball players when they were 11. They don't challenge the L.A. Lakers to a game. They
mm-hmm.
just throw balls into the basket 100 times every afternoon. That you've got to practice writing. So read a lot and write a lot and listen well, because it's all your material, all of these things that are happening in the world that people are talking about. Pay attention to what's going on around you. So that's my advice for young writers.
Did you do much writing when you were a child, Karen, or did you come to
it
more? You did, okay.
I wrote all the time. I was always what my parents would call scribbling,
mm-hmm.
you know. Either I had my nose in a book or I was scribbling, neither of which they really understood. So I did write a lot, but I didn't write at all after I graduated from college and went into the real world and had
mm-hmm.
jobs and things until Phil challenged me that morning to write it down. So it was a long break of 3 years or something there. But I did go back, and I'm very glad that I did.
Mm-hmm. Would you have any advice for someone who has written a book that is a harder sell because it's written in an unusual style? And how would you get that book published?
Have you written a book, Joan?
Well, I'm kind of in the middle of one.
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, I think that publishing a whole book is very difficult for a young person. There are lots of places, like I think it's Stone Soup is still around, and a number of places that will publish young people's writing. And that what helps if you want to publish a book is to have this backlog, sort of like a resume of things that you have published. So write little articles for the school newspaper. Check out some of these places that publish children's writing and get your things published there. And then you can take that to a publisher with an unusual book and say, see, this is how I write. This is how I have been published. And that will give you, you know, a background to share with them. I think that the world right now is very open to books with unusual subject matter or unusual
mm-hmm.
style. So I don't think that that is a stopping point at all.
I agree.
I think that it's much more difficult for a young person to get a book published than a grown-up person, though that might be unfair, because I'm sure a lot of young people's writing is excellent, but I think it's a harder sell.
Mm-hmm.
So I wish you good luck, and remember you have to write at least 27 versions of this book. polish it and get it really, really, really good. It's got to be the best you can do before you set out to sell it.
Karen, can you let us know what you're working on now?
Well, I'm working very sporadically on a book set in 1941 in San Diego right before Pearl Harbor. So that hasn't happened yet, but there is this sort of sense of doom and and something happening because the war is going on in Europe, and it's a girl who lives on or near the beach, and how her life she hates change, and how her life is changing with all these world situations. So I hope it's sort of funny and not all gloomy. I think I've got at this point 6,000 words, but that's all. So I'm not very far.
How old is your main character in this book?
Probably the same age. I seem to be stuck there in my development. I'm at a permanent adolescent stage, so I think she's about 13, yes.
Well, that brings us to the end of our official questions. Is there anything that you wanted the chance to talk about that didn't come up today?
Well, I just want to talk to all of your readers and your listeners. I think this is a fabulous thing, what you're doing, and I love to see young people encouraged to read more and to write more and to comment on this world, which definitely needs commenting on.
Yes.
So congratulations to all of them on being terrific young women who are interested in the world and in reflecting on it. And I wish them all a great fortune.
Oh, thank you so much, Karen. I think that they'll really appreciate hearing from you. Our members, you know, they're big, big readers. A lot of them have read your work, so they'll really appreciate the message.
Great. Well, thank you for this opportunity. I appreciate it, and thank you for what you do for them.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Luna's Reading Corner podcast. Make sure to visit Luna's Reading Corner on the New Moon Girls member site for even more book and reading-related goodies. Luna's Reading Corner is a members-only area of New Moon Girls, so make sure you are logged in to get there. Until next time, happy reading!